KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
High in the low 50s.
I think it's pretty clear to me and to many, many others that we need new leadership in the mayor's office, and I'm prepared to provide that.
Jefferson grew up with this great drama of this great tall figure, and so he wanted to be that.
I want to state my commitment to making sure early education stays funded and that we continue to improve our education system to keep up with this global economy.
Looking at different ways leadership expresses itself this hour on Weekday, we're going to talk to State Senator Steve Litzau on education funding as legislatures figure out a way to find that additional money the Supreme Court of this state said has to be spent on education. John Meacham on how Thomas Jefferson provided leadership and wielded power. And Tim Burgess on what kind of leadership he would bring as Seattle mayor. Tim Burgess is a Seattle City Council member. He has was first elected in 2007, reelected in 2011. He has been a journalist, police officer, a detective. He's worked on global anti-poverty issues, also been a small business owner, and now, for some reason, would like a job where he would be, people would be taking pot shots at him all the time. Why would you want to get rid of that fine city council job for a job as mayor?
Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, sir.
And I love my city council job. It's very fulfilling, and it's a great honor to serve the people of Seattle in that capacity. It's very clear to me that we need new leadership in the mayor's office, and leadership that focuses on bringing us together and bridging the differences that we may have and getting things done for our city and our region. And as you just mentioned in your opening, I think I have a unique set of life experiences that have prepared me well to serve the people of Seattle, and we'll see if they agree.
When you say new leadership to bring us together, we were thinking about how the previous mayor had a relationship with the governor over the tunnel, the 99 tunnel, which though may have not brought us together statewide, did end up with the promise that Seattle isn't responsible for those cost overruns. Wasn't his playing tough a good move? So maybe being a little fractious and not being bringing us together.
Current mayor, not the previous.
Oh, I'm sorry. Look, I've already taken him out of office. He'll love that. He'll love that. Yes,
that's right.
The current mayor, Mayor McGinn.
I think the city council was incredibly strong throughout that entire process. We stayed focused on what our outcome was. We dug into the facts and related well with our regional partners on the replacement of the Alaskan Way Viaduct. And as a result of those partnerships and the steadfast dedication of the city council to that project, it's underway and it's moving forward.
So you're giving the council more credit than the mayor for his playing that hand.
I think that's abundantly clear.
He would probably disagree with you on that, so I'm asking.
Well, I'm sure he would, and that's okay.
When you look at Tim Burgess versus Mike McGinn, what would a Tim Burgess mayor, how would a Tim Burgess mayor act differently on the budget than a Mike McGinn mayor?
I think you can get a glimpse of that in what I've accomplished on the city council and where I've placed my energies and my focus. Take the families and education levy. Back in 2010, I started to prepare my colleagues on the council and members of the community for the renewal of that seven-year levy that's aimed at our most academically at-risk children. And through that process and bringing together a stakeholder group of community leaders, we not only redesigned that levy, but we doubled it in size. And I led that effort to persuade first my colleagues on the council to place that on the ballot in tough economic times, and then the voters overwhelmingly approved it. And that levy is functioning today, and kids in our schools, some of our difficult and most needy schools, are receiving the kind of interventions that the voters of Seattle wanted to do. And that's an example of how I brought people from very divergent perspectives together and rallied them around this common cause.
Who was most unwilling to come together on that family and education levy? Who'd you have to persuade?
I think that the issue there was focused on our accountability measures and how we would evaluate programs and where money should be invested. And it's not that people were opposed to accountability and good measures, but there was apprehension and concern that some might be left out in that process. And then the issue of doubling the size of the levy in tough economic times. I remember the day that the Citizen Advisory Planning Group discussed the size of the renewal, and there was a lot of concern that we should be cautious, that we should renew it at either the same level as it was or maybe up just a bit. And I remember standing up and giving a talk to that group and encouraging them to lead boldly. And thankfully, the citizens of Seattle agreed. So I just cite that as one example of being able to work with a very diverse group of people for the benefit of our school children.
Tim Burgess is a Seattle City Council member. He officially put his hat into the ring for the 2013 mayoral election for the city of Seattle last night. He's talking about that today on Weekday on KUOW Seattle. If you were mayor, as somebody who's been a police officer, what would be your first efforts to assure that the oversight that's being brought to the SPD is fair but brings citizens into the mix?
We have a significant challenge with that issue. And I think as the mayor of a city, the most important appointment or the most important hire that a mayor will ever do is that of the police chief. And the mayor and the police chief and the top commanders of the police department set the tone, set the standards of behavior. It's a crucial, crucial assignment for a mayor. If I'm successful in this campaign, I'll be looking at all of the department heads in the various city departments, including the police chief, and making a judgment about who should continue and who should not.
All right. Well, you've just told John Diaz that he may or may not have that job. What do you look for in a police chief?
I think you look for someone who's able to articulate standards and expectations clearly and well, both in the community and within the police department. You look for someone who understands how policing in America is changing very dramatically from a shift of almost exclusively being focused on the policing of people in favor of the policing of place, where we know crime is geographically concentrated. The focus on what we refer to as problem-oriented policing, where the police and the community join together as true partners to solve problems, focusing on those persistent high-frequency offenders who cause the most harm. When police departments shift in these directions, the legitimacy of policing increases. The willingness of citizens to cooperate with the police and to be the active guardians of their neighborhoods where they live and work and play goes way up. Our department has taken some steps in these directions. That's good. We need to do a lot more.
How do you think that the change in marijuana laws would free up resources for a Seattle Police Department?
Well, in Seattle, it may have some impact, but you'll remember that it was already a low priority for our police department for several years.
Then how do you think it might affect the communities, or those places of crime that you were talking about?
I don't think it's going to have an appreciable impact in a negative way. I mean, obviously, you're not going to be able to smoke marijuana in public. But that is not our crime problem in our city. Our crime problem centers more on violent crime, some crimes against property. It's very focused in specific micro places. Those are the challenges we have.
How would you have reacted if you had been mayor during that spate of killings that we saw at the beginning of the year all the way through into summer.
I think the police department's response to that in their dedicated patrols, their anti-violence patrols, their beefed up investigations, their very quick investigations related to those cases was a good response. And our homicide rate is back to what is more the norm of what we see.
You saw leadership from the upper branches of the police department too?
Yes, and from the rank and file officers of our department.
By the way, in terms of rank and file, your mayor, one of the first calls you make, I imagine, would be the Police Officers Guild. What do you say to Rich O'Neill about how you want to work with him, the head of the guild?
Rich and I have a very open line of communication today, and we also understand where we disagree and where we have differences of opinion. I'm very open and direct with him, as I am with others in the police department, about my expectations. As a council member, I will certainly continue to do that if I'm elected mayor of the city.
Jay Inslee, Rob McKenna, mm-hmm. Barack Obama, and Mitt Romney all talked about how government was going to help in some way create jobs. What's the role of the mayor in any way in helping create a climate for a business opportunity here? And for a healthy labor force.
Yeah, I think you just used the words that are key there. I think the city government has a responsibility to create a climate, to create an environment where businesses are going to thrive, where entrepreneurs know that they can set up shop in Seattle and hopefully be successful. We do that through our land use policies. We do that through our tax and fee policies.
Do entrepreneurs know that now?
I think Seattle's a great place to start a business. And if you look around the city, South Lake Union, the University District, where we are now, other parts of Seattle, there's great potential here. And we've seen really very positive developments in recent years.
You hear some rumblings from the Chamber of Commerce that it's not so positive. That...
You know, we hear rumblings and complaints from all kinds of folks about a lot of different issues.
Are they wrong? Is the chamber wrong?
It's not that they're wrong or that they're right. I think they will raise valid concerns that go all the way from what's happening on the streets around their shops and businesses and whether or not people feel safe to pretty sophisticated arguments about tax policy that should be adjusted or changed or whatever.
Is there anything for you in that as a tax policy you would change?
Well, we have changed some tax policies. I led the effort on the council several years ago to reduce the business and occupation tax for live music venues. Earlier this year, we changed the tax policy of the city with regard to federal grants going to bioscience research and development, and remove that tax in order to allow that industry to flourish even more in Seattle, and it's doing really, really well.
Potholes and parking, that's usually what it comes down to for many mayors, and cleaning the streets when it snows. What would you do?
It won't snow if I'm mayor.
It won't snow. If Tim Burgess is mayor, it will not snow. What would you do? In terms of especially parking, what policies would you change? Do we need to encourage more or fewer people driving downtown? Do they need more or fewer parking spaces downtown, for example?
I think our transportation policies need to center on fixing what we have and maintaining, as you mentioned, our streets, fixing potholes, et cetera. So fixing what we have, finishing what we've already started, and we've got some very exciting progressive transportation policies in our city with regard to the streetcar on Broadway and the connector downtown, the study of a possible route to Ballard. You mentioned State Route 99. All of those projects need to be finished on time and within budget, hopefully. But then also planning effectively for the future. And a couple of years ago, we at the council made significant changes in downtown on-street parking policies, which have proven to be quite effective in making sure that there's good turnover for our retail shop owners, and also efforts to as we're starting now, to protect freight mobility in the SoTo area. So transportation is critically important, and it's not that we should be saying to people, you can't drive anymore, because a lot of people do drive. what's important for me is that we are providing an array of transportation options for people with a significant focus on public transit, light rail, those types of things, because especially in Seattle with our geographic shape, we need to have public transportation options that do not rely exclusively on private automobiles.
All right, sir. I imagine we will be talking again over this year.
I'm sure we will.
Tim Burgess has announced he is running for mayor of the city of Seattle, tossed his hat into the ring. Thank you again.
Thank you very much, Steve. Thanks.
And this is Weekday.
It's 9:21. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. Claudia Rowe has been a journalist for more than 20 years, writing most recently for the New York Times and the Seattle PI. Later today, she joins us to talk about the changing landscape of journalism in 2012, specifically how demand for profit is driving news coverage. Claudia Rowe sits down with KUOW's Ross Reynolds this afternoon at 12:40.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Symphony, presenting the Wyckoff Masterworks Concert. Morlot conducts Mahler's Symphony No. 4 on November 29th and December 1st at Benaroya Hall. Tickets online at seattlesymphony.org.
We have clouds and 45 degrees in Seattle, working towards a high of 49. We're expecting clouds all day with rain this afternoon. Clouds and showers tonight and tomorrow. Tonight's low in the mid-40s. Tomorrow's high in the low 50s.
Well, all right, we'll go. Maybe you don't want to run for mayor. Maybe you want to perhaps write a children's book. Jill Brazier based her children's book, Dolly, the Guatemalan Street Dog, on her experiences living in Guatemala in a treehouse. How did she turn it into a book? KUOW's Katie Sewell, the producer of this show, was wondering about that.
Yeah, she published the book independently. So I was wondering, how do you actually go about doing that? And what kind of an investment, both in time and money, is it? So I invited her into the studio and I asked her why she wanted to write an illustrated book for children.
I've always loved writing and never had aspirations to write a children's book until I had my experience living down in Guatemala. While I was there, I met Dolly, who was a little starving street dog. I had no desire to get involved in this situation, but Dolly found me, and I fed her a little piece of bread, and the rest is history. We ended up spending the next 14 years together, and the components of that experience just seemed so perfect for a children's story. And it became this idea that just would not go away and it wouldn't leave me alone until I finally brought it to fruition.
I know you published this book independently. Why did you decide to do it that way?
I decided to publish independently after there's a very important point when you're publishing a picture book for kids that will direct your path. So I never wanted to publish independently. There are many, many self-published and independently published books these days. In my mind, I really looked at that initially as an absolute last resort. When it comes to children's books, particularly as a first-time author, when you're submitting your manuscript to a traditional publishing house, you're selling your manuscript and you're giving up the rest of the creative control and input that you can have as an author, unless you illustrate it yourself. So there's author, illustrator, you send it all in. Otherwise, you're just giving your manuscript and letting the illustrations be up to the publisher. I really wanted to have creative control and choice in who did the artwork, not only so that Dolly would look like Dolly and the treehouse would be representative of our experience, but so that the artwork could evoke that particular feeling and sense of awe and wonder that I was trying to express.
Do you think that you couldn't have gotten those opinions clear to your publisher?
I think that's true. Really and truly, and based on all my understanding, you send the manuscript in, and if they accept it, then that is the end of your input. Maybe that's different for authors that are more experienced or have other publications, but that was one thing point that was made extremely abundantly clear was when you send in, for example, a photo of Dolly or a little drawing that's my idea or my vision, it makes you look very much like an amateur. When you sell your manuscript, you're really selling just that and then leaving the rest up to them. It's interesting. I suppose it's sort of like having a novel become a movie. You know, there's a certain amount of letting go, and sometimes that's okay. If I had known that going in, I still would have done the same thing.
Who is your artist?
So the artist is Marcio Diaz. He is a Seattle-based artist who's originally from Nicaragua. He's a wonderful person. It took a very, very long time to find Marcio. I went through many, many, many artists along the way. He's just amazing because he's from a small town in Nicaragua that's similar to where we lived in San Marcos in Guatemala. He had a very clear understanding of the natural flora and fauna, the feeling and the color. And that was really the biggest part of this. Marcio also got to meet Dolly. And in fact, all the key players in this book, you know, from the woman that served as the translator to the designer, all had the opportunity to meet Dolly. She died throughout this process, but they were all able to meet her. And I think that was a really important part of it, particularly for Marcio to really express this feeling.
Speaking with Jill Brazier, she wrote a children's book called Dolly the Guatemalan Street Dog, The Sounds of San Marcos, from her real experience living in Guatemala in a treehouse. And this book is the first of a series of books. Now, doing this independently, it doesn't seem like it would be a cheap project.
It is not.
Can you let us in on how expensive it is to actually undertake this sort of a project?
It depends on your standard, I suppose, of quality. So for me, I definitely was committed to the highest quality for printing, for design and layout, and the artwork as well, every single part. I had ideas going into it that I would do the design and layout, or that I would do the illustrations. And, you know, each one of these, I found one of the most important lessons is always work with a professional. That costs more, but you get a much better product. So for me, I'd say it's well over $10,000 to have this final product. Well over. It's probably more in the ballpark of $20,000. So it's not inexpensive.
So how does that work as far as you getting distribution for this book and then recouping some of your investment?
Right now, I'm completely independent and still serving as my own distributor, which I'm going to change because that's not an effective model. It's obviously the distributor and the bookseller take a percentage. In my mind now, you know, a few months into the process, I've come to find out it makes much more sense to just go with a distributor. There are two local distributors who now I'll be pursuing in hopes that they pick up the book. That makes it much easier for both the bookseller and for me. At this point, my book is an exception on the bookshelves. It's not as easy for the bookseller to replenish their stock because they can't call the one person they normally call. They have to call me. And I try hard not to be a nuisance and call and check in too often. So I think it'll be best just to go with a local distributor for now.
How did you get it into bookstores in the first place?
I just walked in there. Now, this is an interesting thing. I mean, each bookstore has their own process. And I have definitely learned that I thought, oh, yeah, I know that your process is do it online, but I'm just going to go in with my book anyway. I'm so excited. And that's definitely not the way to do it. It is best to respect their process and go through the proper steps. Mainly because there are so many self-published books these days, and I think they're getting a lot of solicitation. And children's books are, I think, also a dime a dozen when it comes to independent self-published books.
Where do you see it going from here?
Yeah, that has really evolved. Once the book was published, I definitely had a vision for it that was huge. And now I see that it's much more of a slow growth, and it's really brought me back to look at the real intent for why I wanted to do this.
So is it not about profit so much for you as letting kids know the story of this dog you knew?
It's, If you are in it for the money, then I would say writing a children's book is not not the path to go down. Of course, I want to have a smart business model and recoup some of the money that's gone into this. It has been an investment. So I absolutely foresee making that money back, at least breaking even and being able to complete the series, mainly so that I can continue writing.
What is the best piece of advice you got along the way?
When it comes to writing, one of the things that I learned along the way is to write the story that only you can write. Alternatively, you could write for the market, write for whatever is hot right now. Then I would have written a Dolly vampire story. But staying true to the story that I can write, I think, was one of the best pieces of advice that I received. And ultimately, that's what I did. So I'm happy with that.
Jill Brazier is the author of the book Dolly, the Guatemalan Street Dog, The Sounds of San Marcos. You can find it at UW Bookstore and on Amazon. This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell.
You can find links to the book and some pictures. You can start at our Facebook page, Weekday on KUOW, dollybook.com. As you know, the Washington State Supreme Court in the McCleary decision has ruled that Washington State has not been meeting its constitutional requirement to fund schools. During the course of the governor's campaign, both candidates said they could meet the requirements, maybe $1 billion this year, maybe 1.6 this biennium, maybe 1.6 the next biennium, in addition, 1.6 billion in additional funds for Washington State education without raising taxes. But people are trying to figure out how the math will actually work. On November 20th, the Joint Task Force Education Funding met to hear proposals on revenue options that would provide adequate funding for Washington State schools in the coming years. The Joint Task Force, which is from the Washington Legislature, as well as members of the education community appointed by the governor, has until December 31st to come up with funding recommendations to take to the legislature and the governor. So far, proposals have included raising taxes or a levy swap of some kind, as we heard about. Senator Steve Litzau represents the 41st Legislative District. He's a Republican member of the Joint Task Force on Education Funding. He joins us to give us more on what's happening with that task force and how we provide adequate funding. Senator Litzau, thanks for talking to us.
Oh, thank you, Steve. Appreciate it.
So, first of all, on December 5th, you're going to hear proposals from other stakeholders. What do you want to see happen in this next meeting?
Basically, let's lay out all the options about how to fund it and where does the money come from. And there's three big buckets. It's kind of new taxes, it's growth revenue, and then cuts or caps to non-education spending. And so what I'm going to be interested in is seeing how the different stakeholders kind of mix and match those groups.
Do they, you're going to get to business, you're going to get labor, you're going to get education folks all submitting ideas. You're going to hear people giving you various formulas for which bucket should have the most ladles taken out of it.
Exactly.
So Senator Litzau, what do you think? What's the adequate amount of money to fund education?
I think the number is probably somewhere between $1 and $2 billion.
In additional dollars.
Yes. And I think what's going to happen, and my goal with this whole committee, is if we can, in a bipartisan way, agree to what is that number, or that at least narrow that range, that would be a huge success for coming out of this committee. Because then we'll get into the legislature and actually take the proposals we hear on the 5th and get into the details of how that works.
Do you feel the urgency? Is that December 31st deadline a real deadline that you and the other members of this committee are confronting?
Oh, yes. I mean, we have to have a report to the legislature. My sense is we're going to be able to agree to what we think the number is, and then there will be a number of options on the table about how to actually fund that number. I don't know if the committee will get to a majority agreement on how to do that, but as long as we can agree to what the actual number is, how big that box is, that's a huge success.
I mean, part of your problem is agreement, isn't it? Senator Senator. Superintendent Randy Dorn is suggesting in the billions, as you had. Some of the proposals you heard on November 20th in the previous meeting that your task force had, they only were bringing in numbers in the billion, in the millions. So there's a lot of money that you have to find.
Yes, there is.
Do you think it can be done without raising taxes? Realistically,
I think we have to look at it. As you know, Governor Inslee has proposed that. I'm very interested to see how he proposes doing that. We know that there is going to be some revenue growth coming off of, you know, just the economy coming back. I think it's going to be difficult to get there. I mean, our big concern is making sure if the child is hungry or unhealthy or homeless and they come to school, they're not going to be able to learn regardless of how much money or what kind of policies we have in the classroom. And so we've got to be really careful to make sure we're looking at the whole child and making sure that they can learn.
How about that for a minute before we come back to the numbers? How about that? No additional money, $1 billion, $2 billion here or there. Why? What do you think that brings to reforming education when so much of the discussion about education is not just about the money, but about the way we teach our kids? Couldn't all that additional money just get wasted?
Well, no, but in our view on the Republican side, and I know I've had conversations with Senator Frocht and Representative Hunter as well, is, yes, you're right, it's part of it's money, but part of it's got to be policy. We're not interested in putting new money in the old system, right? We've got a 75-76% graduation rate. We're one of 9 states in the country where that graduation rate has not shrunk in 10 years. You know, that's 20,000 kids a year that are not graduating. That is unacceptable. So putting more money into the current system and expecting different results is, you know, the definition of, I think, insanity. So one of the things that we've all been working on, which you won't see in the committee, but you'll see in the legislature, is how do we continue to improve the system so that we have kids that are graduating and can go on to college or get into a career? Right? I mean, we've got UW and Wazoo are yelling at us because 50% of the kids that do graduate need remedial work, and it's just unacceptable.
Well, I heard a clip from you at the beginning of this hour where you said that it was important to maintain our funding of early childhood education. That was one of the things the governor said that she was most proud of in accomplishing over her tenure as governor. A lot of people say if we have to make cuts or shift somewhere, a lot of people say, studies tell us, that early childhood education is going to give every kid an equal step up if you're starting at 0 and going to 3. So is that part of your Republican colleagues thinking about choices that have to be made?
Oh, without a doubt. Early education is by far, and all the studies show this, the most cost-effective, greatest return on an education investment. You know, I sit on the Thrive by 5 board as well, and the research that's coming out of particularly UW, you know, that 0 to 3, if you get them to read, get them to recognize letters, start working with them, their ability to be school ready by kindergarten is enormous.
So then, go ahead, finish. I'm sorry.
That's it.
Well, I was just going to say, so given that, Senator Litz, so yes, you're hearing from the UW and WSU about the students that are coming to them now, but in a tough time when choices have to be made for the future, isn't it better to concentrate your limited resources on pre-K to 12 and I guess continue to ask higher ed to bear some more of the burden?
I think we've asked higher ed to bear the burden for too much over the past 10 years. I mean, I think we need to start looking at the education system as, you know, called 0 up to through college. Because at the moment, if I can't get kids ready for kindergarten and K-12, and if they're not coming out of K-12 ready to get a college degree or go to work, they're not going to become productive citizens, right? Microsoft has 6,000 open headcount, all that require a computer science degree or engineering degree that they cannot fill, right? They will, and we've sat down with them, they will move those out of this state to where they can fill them. I mean, that is, you know, the whole, our economy and our entire structure depends on our ability to attract jobs and be able to fill those jobs with our graduates. There's no better job program than a great education.
All right. Well, then this Senator Lizzo, who represents Mercer Island in the 41st Legislative District as a Republican. He's a member of the Joint Task Force on Education Funding, which has until December 31st to come up with some recommendations for the incoming governor and the legislature to meet the McCleary decision requirements that Washington State more amply fund education. So among the proposals that have been floated already were a couple of temporary taxes from Susan Enfield and Mr. Vinson, the chair of this committee, an excise tax on beer and the B&O surtax on some services that might be made permanent, extend the sales tax to some consumer services, maybe even a new 5% tax added to the price of event admission tickets. You're sort of nibbling around the edges here, but it's worth, those folks said, $935 million in the next biennium, so it does get you closer. What kind of support do you think you would have from your Republican colleagues to join in to accept by two-thirds tax increases?
I think right now everything's on the table. And in my conversations with my colleagues, everything's on the table. The question's going to become, what are we doing to improve the system, right? We're looking at both sides of this coin. Both, okay, if it's taxes and cuts and growth, okay, how do you get there? How does that work? What does that do to our business climate and our small businesses? And then as important is, what changes are we making to the system to improve it? How do we make sure every child graduates on time? How do we make sure every fourth grader is reading at grade level? Because we have no interest in putting more money in the old system.
Well, unless we're going to reinventing education again, this state has gone through some reform efforts. You had a charter school amendment pass. Yep. Why not just say, okay, here's where we're putting our eggs for now. We'll see what works next while we fund education to the standards the Supreme Court has set.
What the Supreme Court said is, you guys have defined education and you haven't funded how you've defined it. If you want to change the definition, great. They've defined education as being able to educate a child so that they are competitive in the workplace as well as participate in democracy. We right now are failing an entire generation of kids that aren't graduating ready to either get a career or go to college. We don't have time to wait. We've got to continue to improve the system. Charter schools, you're talking, 40 schools out of 2,300. Good program, very targeted, make an effort. We need to figure out, how do we start blending technology into the system? How do we start, promoting more science, technology, engineering, and math? We don't have time to wait to see, maybe this will work. I mean, everything you look at, Washington basically says money isn't the only answer. And so unless we, truly figure out how to continue to improve our system, we're going to wind up in the same issue we are now. But the problem is, we aren't going to have kids graduating.
All right, sir. Let's have this conversation again as you guys get closer to coming up with some decisions about how you'll fund education. I appreciate you talking to us.
Great. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you. Senator Steve Lizzo represents the 41st Legislative District. He's a Republican member of the Joint Task Force on Education Funding. They are holding hearings, the next one December 5th, to hear from stakeholders. By December 31st, they have to have a recommendation to go to the legislature and the new governor about how to amply fund education in Washington State. This is Weekday.
Chris Christie files papers for a second term in Jersey.
I'm in this for the long haul.
Grover Norquist warns that voters will hold Republicans to their anti-tax pledges. Jesse Jackson Jr. resigns. I'm Neil Cunnan. Political junkie Ken Rudin returns, plus once and future Minnesota Congressman Rick Nolan. And Ralph Reed argues social conservatives can't be blamed for Romney's loss. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
That comes your way this morning at 11 on our second program service, KUOW2. Good morning, it's 9:43.
Support for KUOW comes from Evo, a ski and snowboard shop announcing the grand opening of their flagship store, now located at 35th and Stone Way, featuring technical outerwear and casual clothing from Burton, The North Face, Armada, and more. More online at evo.com/Seattle.
We have cloudy skies and 46 degrees in Seattle. We're expecting clouds all day, rain this afternoon, the high getting up to 49. Clouds and showers expected tonight and tomorrow. Tonight's low in the mid-40s, tomorrow's high in the low 50s.
Support for KUOW comes from Top 10 Toys, whose mission is keeping healthy play alive with classic hands-on toys. Open every day in the Greenwood neighborhood of North Seattle and in Pacific Place in downtown Seattle.
Who was Thomas Jefferson? How did he become the man we have come to know? John Meacham has written about it in Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. John Meacham is a Pulitzer Prize winner for his work on Andrew Jackson. John Meacham, remind us, what's on Jefferson's tomb, his headstone? What were the three things he wanted to be remembered for?
He designed it. I don't know if you designed yours yet.
I have not.
I'm worried about mine. It's a sign of some self-regard, isn't it, that people would be coming to look at it. So he suspected you and I would be talking about him right now without any question. The three things are that he was the author of the Declaration of Independence, the author of the Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty, and the founder of the University of Virginia.
Now, who was this man who could, in the end, write the Declaration of Independence? I mean, where did he come from, or what were his influences that he was a fairly young man when he wrote these amazing ideas?
Yeah, 33 years old. Yeah, he was born on the 13th of April, 1743, the eldest son of a well-off planter and farmer, surveyor in Virginia, Peter Jefferson, big, tall man. Jefferson knew that his father was a man that other men admired and always wanted to be that as well. Peter Jefferson had a library with Shakespeare, The Spectator, kind of the typical upper-class library of those days. Was a surveyor and explorer, helped fix the boundary line between Virginia and North Carolina, had a great adventure, got separated from the rest of the surveying party and had to kill wild animals with his hands and eat them raw. You know, it's just, you know, sort of survivor meets colonial times.
Wow.
Jefferson grew up with this great drama of this great tall figure. And so he wanted to be that. And he went to William and Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia, and that was the critical intellectual development, a critical intellectual moment, because there was a teacher there, a professor of mathematics and natural philosophy, which basically meant everything, named William Small. And William Small was the conduit, really, for the European and Scottish Enlightenment for Jefferson. And suddenly Jefferson was learning about, you know, what Kant would call the Enlightenment being man's the freeing of man's mind from the chains of superstition and received dogma, creating a culture of discovery and innovation and questioning. And he was intoxicated by this thinking, and at the same time he was equally intoxicated by the other big thing going on in Williamsburg, which was the business of governing the colony of Virginia. He fell in with Small, was his professor, was great friends with the leading lawyer of the day and with the royal lieutenant governor who lived in the great royal palace there on the green, still there in Williamsburg. Jefferson would be brought in and they would eat. You know, he would have supper with them. He would play the violin for them. And he loved it. He loved it. It was opening up whole new worlds, both intellectually and politically. And then by the time he's 25, after he reads law, he becomes a member of the House of Burgesses as the revolution is gaining force, as we head that way, and became one of the more unlikely revolutionaries. You know, here's a rich man who had a pretty good life, and yet chose to rebel both for economic reasons, I think, and for intellectual and philosophical reasons.
What were the economic reasons?
He owed a lot of money to a lot of Englishmen. Virginia planters were a famously indebted class, and that was part of it. The other part was that the king was taking steps to limit the growth and granting of Western lands. Virginia basically expanded all the way to Hawaii then, more or less. And there had been a very wide-ranging, very generous-handed policy about settling and claiming those lands. And that was felt, as the king constricted that, that was felt to be an encroachment, which is a great 18th century word. They always feared encroachment on individual liberties, on the liberty of the colonists. And the other was royal vetoes. As a aspiring legislator, the fact that the king began vetoing more and more colonial pieces of legislation was convincing them that the walls were closing in, that just as America was getting stronger and bigger and more interested in their own, having their own way, the king stepped in. And the pressure that came from the monarchy, that came from London, as well as these economic factors, created a fatal fire.
Boy, sometimes you listen to the complaints they had, these wealthy planters and the like, and then you listen or read the rhetoric that they used to make their case. And it seems they reached very high. I mean, looking back on it, it doesn't feel as overstated. But sometimes when you read the text, it seems, boy, they were really complaining pretty heavily over things that were not as – didn't seem as life and death as they could have for these wealthier people.
That's absolutely right. But, you know, that's what politics is like when you think about it. You know, political rhetorics grow stale pretty fast. And the consuming drama of one year is the dim, barely recalled memory of another year. And, you know, we could think of a million examples right now of things that seem to be existential and critical to us, but were either resolved or we moved on, something changed. That's always been true. And I agree that, you know, the Declaration of Independence, I mean, some of the items that Jefferson wrote as causes to break away, even people in real time weren't quite sure what he was talking about. So he was sort of gathering everything he could and throwing it in there. It's like the old rule, you know, a grand jury will indict a ham sandwich. You know, well, in this case, they were throwing all the evidence they could, including ham sandwiches, in. John, but it was Virginia. But it was Virginia ham.
It was Virginia ham. John Meacham is author of Thomas Jefferson: The Art of Power. You write about, though Jefferson had long cultivated a skeptical religious worldview, he undertook his work in the General Assembly. Now we're talking about Virginia here and his religious freedoms, because of freedom, not because lack of faith. This dovetails in what you're saying. He wanted the enlightened people to feel free to have faith but not oppressed by it.
Absolutely. It embarrassed him that the established church in Virginia, your civil rights, rights of custody, the ability to hold military office, was linked to religious observance. He thought that was the worst kind of superstition. He once said that the Holy Trinity was the mere abracadabra of men calling themselves the priests of Jesus. He understood the cultural utility of religion, supported that, did not believe the government should be in the business, the state should be in the business of, to use a modern phrase, of picking winners between religions. He believed that there should be, as he put it, a wall of separation between church and state. Though he understood that you couldn't put a full wall between religion and politics because they were both about people. They were about motivations and who they were. But by emphasizing liberty, he was on very strong theological and political ground. He actually wrote in a notebook, it's one of my favorite things in the book, that basically if – does it really? Are you really saying? He wrote to the advocates of an established church that the gates of hell are going to prevail if we don't pass a piece of legislation. You know, if the Lord God of Hosts is watching the Virginia General Assembly, the Lord God of Hosts doesn't have much going on. And so he was able with a certain kind of wit to put, I think, the harder core establishmentarian religious folks in their place without being disrespectful of religion. He just thought that it was a personal matter, a private matter, and that's where it should be.
And he weaves in his last great effort, the University of Virginia, he weaves those religious leaders into his cause by inviting them in, but making them pay for it.
This is so much fun. You're picking these things that are all my kind of quiet favorites. Yes, he founds the university. He tries to appoint. He gets a lot of pressure. Tries to appoint a Unitarian, and the legislature goes crazy because they want a Protestant. And they want a chaplain and a divinity school and all this. And Jefferson doesn't. He doesn't want a chaplain. He doesn't want a divinity school. So he says to the denominations, to the Baptists, the Episcopalians, the Quakers, everybody, says Presbyterians, we would be happy to have you on campus in any sort of headquarters you would like to build and fund and maintain. And guess what? No denomination wanted to cough up the cash to do it. So they were actually looking for state support. And that's what he didn't want. He didn't think that public money should go to these private religious institutions and that religion should stand on its own in the marketplace of ideas and fight itself out. Fight the fight for itself. Don't look for a crutch from the state.
You know, you write about how he wanted the University of Virginia in part because he talked about we don't want to be sending the best of our sons north to Harvard or west to – what was the school to the west?
Oh, Transylvania.
Transylvania.
Kentucky.
That's right. What he would have been a scientist, he said, if he hadn't been what he was. Did he want the future leaders to be as incisive about science as it seems like he did from his efforts to create the University of Virginia?
You know, there's something about him that you want to – that speaks to this age, too, of innovation and technology. He would have totally understood and loved the digital world because it was such a raucous place, marketplace of ideas, and everyone's an editor and everyone can say everything. That would have fascinated him. In terms of science, he believes so deeply in discovery and innovation, and to pull it out as a principle that applies to his educational theory and to his political theory, he believed more than any other of those early founders, I believe, he believed more strongly in the possibilities of progress and the idea that there were mysteries to be discovered, there were riddles to be solved, there were theories to test. There were fossils to be found. You know, when Lewis and Clark sent back artifacts, he laid them out in a room in the White House and invited anyone who wanted to come look at them. He also had two grizzly cubs on the White House lawn that Zebulon Pike sent. That didn't work out quite as well because they started mauling people. But no one can be perfect in their interest. But he believed that there were things to learn. And that's why he wanted to build the university. It's why he supported science. It's why he was endlessly interested in the West and sent Lewis and Clark out there. Because he knew in his own lifetime, he'd seen how far the world had moved. He was born a subject of the British Empire and died as a former president of a free nation. And a statesman of a world that had done more for individual liberty at that point than anybody else had. It had a long, long, long way to go. But he set something in motion in a way that it might not have been set in motion if he had not been there. And I think that ultimately is Thomas Jefferson's legacy, is he started something that the rest of us have to finish.
Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. John Meacham, thank you, sir.
Thank you so much.
John Meacham will talk about Thomas Jefferson at Town Hall tonight at 7:30, you're listening to Weekday on KUOW.
And now,
The sound of the day.
Horror movie. The bees. That's the sound of very busy Italian honeybees racing around weekday listener John's house. He recorded that sound on Sunday. The sun was out. The bees were hard at work, darting in and out of their top bar hive. Listen closely. John says there are many collisions to be heard. They need a little bee traffic control there, I think. What interesting sounds are you hearing? Record 30 seconds. Send it to us via email. Put sound of the day in the subject line and tell us the story behind the sound of your day. Stay with us. Vaughn Palmer, Robert Horton is going to talk about the new Alfred Hitchcock movie, and John Talton and I will look over the fiscal cliff.
Good morning, it's 10 o'clock. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.